Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour autobiography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and an award-winning journalist. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
The title of that Academy Award-nominated song is Patience, from the movie Dreamgirls. The lyrics were written by Willie Reale, whose life proves that patience is a virtue. Willie Reale is the founder of the 52nd Street Project in Manhattan that introduces inner-city children to the theater. 10 years later, he was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, more commonly called the Genius Grant. He also has won 2 Tony Award nominations for his Broadway musical, A Year with Frog and Toad, that he wrote with his brother Robert. He is also the supervising producer for the CBS TV police drama Blue Bloods. And Willie, if we list all your credits, we'd run out of time, but that's something you don't worry about too much because you have, patience.
And a really schizophrenic resume.
And a schizophrenic resume. If you went to a cocktail party and they say, what do you do, Willie? How would you describe yourself?
Whatever I did today. So today I would say, well, I'm working on the CBS drama called Blue Bloods.
About cops.
Yeah.
About cops and robbers. But wouldn't you have other things to say?
I
mean,
here's what I say. I say I write in television and I write in the theater. And I spent the early part of my career founding and running a nonprofit called the 52nd Street Project. And that's the way I put it.
That's the way you put it. Well, let's start with the 52nd Street Project. 1981, the Police Athletic League, run by the police, a foundation run by the New York City Police, calls you up and say, we need a volunteer.
That's correct. I was working in a theater across the street from a PAL center, and they're looking for somebody to go teach a class. I went over there and started teaching a class. After 2 or 3 classes, I said to this group of 8 kids, hey, look, why don't I just write you a play? That'll be fun. And so I went up back across the street to the theater and I said, do you mind if we put on a show here? And they said, no, absolutely. We want to embrace the neighborhood. The Ensemble Studio Theater is the name. It's still there. And so I did this play and kids were terrific. They got laughs. And I'm on my way out the door thinking I had done my good deed. And I literally received a shirt tug from a little girl who had a good experience. And she said to me, well, when's the next play? And in that moment, I knew that I was stuck. And so I said, all right, just show up on Tuesday. But what happened on Tuesday was that I didn't have 8 kids anymore because I had good word of mouth. I had 24 kids. And then I had 35 kids the next class. And that's when I started bringing in my friends to help me divide and conquer them. So over the ensuing 18 years, I developed – with my pals, a number of mentoring programs where the kids get at least one-on-one, sometimes 2 adults per kid, to help them through this process. And it's a full curriculum. I stepped down after 18 years, and now I think it's age 33. It's still going strong.
But these weren't your normal kids. They weren't kids from private schools, even good public schools. They were homeless. They were from hotels, welfare hotels.
Back in those days, there was a mix of neighborhood kids, Hell's Kitchen.
It was 1981.
Kids. Yeah. This is when Hell's Kitchen was – you'd get beat up over there. And so we had those kids, and then they were – the PAL was bussing kids in from the welfare hotels in Times Square. And that was a really needy population, and the work was very vital and absolutely engaging for all of us because we've really felt like we can make a difference in these lives. And in fact, you know, I'm sure we did.
You become a part of their life, don't you?
The little girl who tugged my shirt, I had lunch with her. That was 33 years ago. She's now whatever. I think she's 40. And I had lunch with her two months ago.
What is she doing now? She in the, have you got her volunteering as well?
She actually has volunteered. Her name is Danica, and she is a she's a photographer, and she takes photographs at the annual benefit. She comes and does that.
A volunteer, that means you weren't being paid.
Nobody's getting paid. In the early days, here's how we did it. We had three performances. We had 100 seats. The first two performances were free. The third performance, my brother would make a ham. I would make a turkey. We'd serve sandwiches, and then everybody would pay $20. And then we'd take the 120s, and we would buy the costumes and pay for the light rental with that. That's how we did it.
And you were living among them. I mean, you weren't somebody who's coming from Westchester down to talk to some kids and, you know, feeling good about it.
Well, no, that was what was so compelling for me was because, you know, these kids were living in, you know, and I was living on 43rd Street between 8th and 9th at the time. And in fact, the Holland Hotel was right around the corner. And with my window open, I could hear the kids, you know, playing in the street, my charges. And they would, in fact, when the elevator at the Holland Hotel was broken, they would ring my bell. And pee in my bathroom because it was a shorter climb.
Can't beat that. But eventually you do have to make money. You've got to eat, you've got to survive, and you got to also pay your rent. Did it ever come a time when you actually made a couple of bucks on that? What happened?
Well,
I do know. You know where I'm leading anyway.
Well, sure. I mean, you don't get into that kind of work for the dough. What happened for me was that, you know, people – this woman named Karen Rosa from the Altman Foundation – read about what I was doing with my brother over there, and she came and visited us, and I told the ham and turkey story to her, and she was charmed by that, and she said, well, what would you do if you had any real money? And I said, what's real money? And she said, I'll tell you what, just spend $25,000 on paper for me. And I took it seriously, and that became my first grant proposal. And, you know, once you have a grant, then you need a phone. Once you need a phone, then you need a desk. And then one thing led to another. And now the organization is housed in a beautiful theater of its own with a homework help center. And I think it's a $1.3 million annual budget.
But then came the magic telephone call.
Yeah, this should happen to you. So
it's not going to happen to me.
Your hope springs eternal. Somebody, you know, I got a phone call from the MacArthur Foundation saying, would I, you know, consider being a MacArthur Fellow? And I did not hesitate. And they, you know, and then they gave me a bunch of dough. And that at the time, it was age based. So I think I was 34 then. And so. So I got $50,000 a year for 5 years, which was
bad back then.
It's
1994. Good now, yeah.
I think that year I was, you know, on track to make like $9,000, which I could do because I had like this. You know, I was living in a tenement flat with rent control apartment and all that stuff. It was totally possible to do, but you know, at a certain point, you want to get married and have kids and do all that. And that was not in the cards. And so what I did was I essentially used that grant to get the organization to a place where then I could name a successor and go on and have the writing career that I was sort of planning on having from the start.
The development and marketing director by the name of Jenny Gersten, who you later married, said that she told the New York Times, did you use the money to buy a sport jacket and new shoes, which you hadn't done in a long time? True?
Absolutely, yeah.
Where'd you go?
I went to Madison Avenue for the shoes, to a store called Church's, because I had always passed by that store, and the shoes looked really good to me. And I got the blazer from Macy's.
Okay, well, you're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper and WBGO 88.3 and WBGO.org. Our guest that you've been listening to is Willy Reale, the lyricist and writer who has won every type of entertainment award in the movies, television, and the theater, including two Tony Award nominations for the Broadway musical A Year with Frog and Toad.
How come you won't leave? Because I'm waiting for something. Well, what are you waiting for? I'm waiting to get a load of Toad, get a load of Toad, get a load of Toad. I'm here to get a load of Toad, get a load of Toad, get a load of Toad. Can't wait to of toad, get a load of toad, get a load of toad. Please tell me why. I'll tell you why. Toad looks funny in a bathing suit. Toad looks funny in a bathing suit. It's a riot, it's a hoot. Toad looks funny in a bathing suit.
How did you come up with that?
You know, there are these books that are enormously popular called, it's the Frog and Toad series, written by a guy named Arnold Lobel. And his daughter is a set designer, a very good one, named Adrienne Lobel. And Adrienne approached my brother and me because she had seen something that we'd written that was done at the second stage, a play called Once Around the City. And she really admired the whimsical tone of it. And so she asked us if we would get in league with her to create a musical from her father's books. And I was very skeptical at the start. And then I read through all of these very simple books, but they're beautiful. And the Frog and Toad, it's essentially about a couple. And one is kind of a warrior, and the other one is takes care of him. So that, you know, and it's kind of a beautiful love story in its way, all encased in these little simple allegories. And so we created this little, you know, vaudeville for these critters, and it's beloved. It's I think for I don't know maybe 10 years it was in the top 10 most produced plays in the country. It's just one of these pieces that just goes on and on and on. Kids love it. And the biggest compliment that we get is from parents who say, our kids want to hear it in the car all the time and we don't mind.
My goodness, that is. You seem to spend a lot of time reaching out to children. What's that all about?
I don't know. I just like them.
You have two.
I have a pair. I like them very much.
I'm glad.
Yeah. I think they like me back. I don't know. I'm a person that relates to children, and I'm pretty good at it. And I have a whole adult career. I mean, this TV drama thing that I do is very grown up.
And we'll get to that.
We'll get there. But I also reinvented the electric company for PBS. And we made, I don't know, I think 52 episodes of that, which was very exciting. And I just have I'm able to function in both the adult and the kid world.
Let's talk a little bit about how we started this whole thing, something called Patience and Dream Girls, the movie.
Well, you know, with the 52nd Street Project, I drafted a lot of great, great talent to help create work for the kids to perform in. And the composer, Henry Krieger, who was the composer of the musical Dream Girls with Tom Ion.
The theater version, Broadway.
Henry came to work with us, and he and I think, wrote maybe 200 songs together doing that. We have a great relationship as writers. And when the movie came up, Tom Ion passed away. And when the movie came up, they needed some new songs to work with the screenplay, and I worked with Henry on some of those songs, and we had, you know, and we have such a shorthand. We're such close friends that it was easy to do.
Patience. That's symbolic. It's also philosophical. It's all those kind of things. And when I was looking at the lyrics, they're telling people, take it easy. Your time will come.
Well, I mean, that was written specifically for Eddie Murphy to sing, and you know, certainly the African American population in this country has had to demonstrate quite a bit of patience over the course
Shirelles
of time.
Were involved in that. Almost any group that seemed to have a tough time for a while connecting with America.
Yeah, well, that's you know, their story is long, and has required a good deal of patience. I know that.
And patience is what this is all about. Is it symbolic of anything specific, that song?
Yes. The song is about waiting for change to come and it coming much too slowly.
I was thinking about reading a little bit about Willy Reale. And you also wrote a play or co-wrote a play on baseball called Johnny Baseball. And everybody's talking about how difficult it was for being to be a Red Sox fan up until about 2004 when things changed. And the blame for not winning a World Series for years and years and years was blamed on Babe Ruth. But you blamed it on something called institutional racism. Pretty tricky.
Well, this was not my notion, nor was it the notion of my collaborator, Richard Dresser, who is a dyed-in-the-wool Red Sox fan, and I'm a Yankees fan, so we have lively conversations. But there's a book called Shutout by Howard Bryant, which offers this theory. And it's sort of widely known that the Red Sox were the last team to integrate. And even after they'd integrated, African-American ballplayers didn't want to play there because the town had a reputation and the organization had a reputation. Now, don't forget that in 1945, there was a sham tryout three black ball players went up to try out, and among them was Jackie Robinson. And the word from on high was that these boys are not ready to play baseball.
Just like that, these boys are not ready to play baseball.
Correct.
Can't get any nastier than that.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
What was the reaction? I mean, the reaction to what you were doing, you sort of enclosed it in this, all these happy songs, people jumping up and down, oh my God, it's terrible, we haven't won a pennant, we've won a pennant, we've won a World Series. What was the reaction?
Well, it played like a house on fire in Boston. At the second performance, and we had no idea how they were going to react. At the second performance, this guy comes, he sits in the third row, he's wearing a full Red Sox uniform down to the cleats. And, of course, we have our eye on him through the performance. And there was a talk back where they were, the audience was allowed to ask us questions. And this guy said, I just want to thank you guys for finally telling the truth about my team.
He's white?
Yeah, white guy.
Very white.
Very, yeah. Just the sort of fellow you'd expect to have the opposite reaction. And
What did you say to him?
We said, well, thank you very much. That's exactly what we're trying to do. And tell your friends.
You have this social conscience, which it seems to be in everything you do.
It's true. I want all of my acts to count. And therefore, I everything I do has some sort of meaning, at least to me, But that the Wounded Warriors thing has really taken over some real estate in my life. It's there's a trade union called the Writers Guild of America, and I belong to the Writers Guild of America East, and the charitable arm of that is called the Writers Guild Initiative. And one of the principal activities of the initiative is to run workshops for wounded warriors and their caregivers here in New York, and sometimes we'll go out down to Texas and other places to work. And what we do is we create an opportunity for them to tell their story and to free their voice. And we're very supportive over the course of a weekend, and then they write for 6 months, and then we go back and visit again, and we spend another weekend with them. And I, with my charges, I have been corresponding in one case for 2 years with this one writer. I call her a writer now, and she's really developed quite a bit of really good work. But most of it is most of the work is just to allow these folks a sense of community and to honor their voices.
It sounds to me like a grown-up version of the theater group that you started some long ago.
That's exactly right, Alan. It's not vastly different from that.
And your relationship with them, you said it's really close. Are there anybody particular, any stories you might want to share? People kind of forget about wars and the people who fought them, the people who were in them, because they wanted to or didn't want to. But suddenly they're in Afghanistan and they're in Iraq, and then they come home and everybody forgets about them. Do you feel that?
Well, in the case of some of the caregivers, the wives, many of them are wives, some are mothers. One woman that I was working with is a sister of a wounded vet, and he's come into her care. What's remarkable is how dedicated these moms and wives and family members can be to their veteran, but it's
My veteran, they said.
Life change. Yeah, that's
I
what
saw
they said.
That. Yeah, my veteran. Shouldn't we all be our veterans? Not just there. We should all be part of that.
You know, you're preaching to the choir over here. These guys can get lost, and their stories need to get out there. And you know, we need to honor them for their service.
Is there any result or conclusions that come out of anything that happens afterwards that you can point to that directly resulted from these workshops that you could point to?
You know, I think there's a group that stays together online, one of my groups. And these women have developed – this particular group of women have developed a support group. And they – even you know, because what happens with – like let's say you're in Arkansas and you're in a little town and your veteran comes back and he's not the guy you married. And sometimes he thinks he's, you know, in a house raid. And he's needs a lot of medical care, and you have to stop doing what you're doing, quit your job, and your new job is him. And that takes a lot of strength for a person to do. And I think when someone is in the same boat, and we put these ladies together for the first time in a boat because there's no real community for them. They support each other in ways that are I think really meaningful, and I think that you know apart from the writing that comes out of it, I think those relationships are really really important and an important result of our work.
That's the voice of Willie Reale, writer, lyricist, producer, and also the husband of Jenny Gersten, the executive director of Friends of the High Line. Some life. Tell me a little bit about that life, the personal side, starting in Park Ridge, New Jersey.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in Jersey with four brothers and a sister. And well, actually, there's a kid down the street that he's like the fifth brother. You know, it was a happy-go-lucky life. I was a child of the baby boom. And we had a blast. We lived at the end of a cul-de-sac and we played all day long and without a care. And I just missed Vietnam. I was like 3 years too young for that. And so I kind of skated. It was a very, you know.
You just missed Vietnam, and so you're going up to Albany to try to help some Viet vets, huh?
Well, that's where we're raising money right now to deal with some Vietnam, you know, to create a workshop for those guys up there that really, I think, need a hand.
People who forget. What else? Tell us more.
Well, you know, and then I started writing, and then I got
– Came to New York. It was not an easy place to be way back then. It was, what, 1979, 1980?
Yeah, I moved in 79. And, well, I didn't know if – it was exciting to me. I thought, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, people say, oh, well, you lived in Hell's Kitchen in that time, blah, blah. But I was, you know, I was a part of the community there because I was working with the kids, and so I had a special dispensation in that neighborhood.
And you recruited your wife to work. You became your wife. You recruited her to work in the West 52nd Street project.
Yeah, she's
pretty smart.
She's a dynamo, my wife, and she came on as an intern from Oberlin College in the early days, and then we hired her to be the production manager. Then she became the development director, and then she went off and is now having just this blockbuster career.
She's, then you married her before she took over the whole thing, right? I did. And she has a very, very strong background in the theater.
Her father is Bernard Gersten, who is the just retired from Lincoln Center Theater, which he revived in a way that was remarkable. And prior to that, he had been with Joe Papp's right hand in the public. And so, you know, I mean, that those two things alone on the resume, let alone running Zoetrope for Francis Ford Coppola. And her mother is Cora Kahn, who was in charge of she is the president of the New 42, and she was responsible for changing the block between on 42nd Street between 7th and 8th. She made all the deals in those theaters and, you know, brought Disney in and revived that block. And she built the Joyce Theater, and she, you know, she's another dynamo.
Do your kids have any choice? Are they all going to be doing the same thing, writing, producing, singing? dancing?
They play the piano, and they're pretty good. And they, but you know, there's a, as Bernie, my father-in-law, says, there's a lot of ologies out there. So learn an ology.
Okay, this all helped you, I guess, with your work as supervising producer at Blue Bloods. In a couple of minutes, tell me about that. Does that help you come up with ideas, knowing all this stuff about New York City?
You know, New York is in my blood now, and I'm able to tell, you know, to sort of take stories that are part of me and kind of twist them to get into a Blue Bloods episode. But I know the sound in New Yorkers, I think, pretty well now. And but I have to hand it to this one guy. Ex-detective, ex-NYPD detective. His name is Jimmy Nusiforo. And Jim is – he's our tech advisor on the show. And I spend 20 minutes with him, and he tells – he starts spinning detective stories. And the, you know, oh, there's an episode. Oh, there's another episode. I mean, the guy is just a fountain of NYPD knowledge. He's really fun to be around. He was a a right hand of Jack Maple.
Who is?
Jack Maple is a very well-known cop who was Bratton's right-hand guy. And
I know these things, but there's a whole bunch of people out there who don't.
Oh, well.
Tell them. You have about 30 seconds.
Oh, you know, Jack Maple is this legendary detective who started in the in transit, and he sort of he changed the way that New York City detectives work. He's a fascinating guy, and his book is really terrific, and I can't remember the title of it.
Give me an idea of what you go through as a supervising producer of a show like that, a weekly show where you're working 70, 80, 90 hours a week.
Here's the job. Okay. You come up with an idea for an episode. You run it by the powers that be. They say yes or no.
Selleck.
No, you don't go to Tom yet.
Not yet?
No, there's Leonard Goldberg out in L.A. and this great showrunner named Kevin Wade, who's a playwright and a good guy. And so I bring it to the brass, and they say, oh, good idea. Write that, Willie. And so then you write a 12-page outline. They give you notes, and then you write the script, and they give you notes, and then you do the notes, and then Tom reads it, and then he has an opinion, and he's usually right. And then from there, you meet with the director, you do production rewrites, and then you're on set, and you're babysitting your show. And then you look at the cut that the director puts out, and you make notes on that. And then it goes up and it goes on air, and then you start all over again right away. And you do that 3 or 4 times a year.
Well, my wife and I watch it, and we have to confess, and we're looking at this family that seems to meet every Friday night, you know, after they've caught a crook or knocked somebody over. And we're saying, look how happy they are. You know, I mean, is it real? Is there any family out there that you guys are copying from or stealing from?
You know, that family is the family that we all want. They're always, even when there's enmity, they support each other, and they get together every Sunday is like Thanksgiving. They all eat together, and they're all on the right side of the issues. And I think we all wish we were like that. I think we wish that we could get, and I certainly know that I wish I could get a big pot roast out every Sunday.
Me too. That's the voice of Willie Reale, writer, producer, lyricist. Thank you for sharing your multi-talented entertainment life with us. Joanna Walper is the senior producer of our program. Doug Doyle is the executive producer, and Conrad Saguinadio is our engineer. Dana Damiani is production associate. All of our shows, by the way, are available on demand, or Google us, Conversations with Alan Walper, or you can get a subscription on iTunes. Until our next conversation, I'm Alan Walper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Walper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.